Hello and welcome to A Candle or the Night, a Star Wars Force and Destiny adventure. My name is Albert Caruana. My friends know me as Albie. I am an ophthalmologist living in South Florida, and I've always been a gamer and a fan of science fiction, fantasy, superheroes, and yes, especially Star Wars. As a longtime Dungeons & Dragons player as well, I've been inspired by amazing shows such as Critical Role and There Will Be Dungeons. If you're not already familiar with these shows, I sincerely recommend you look them up. My deep appreciation for the unique experience that these shows have created has caused me to want to produce this show, and I certainly hope you will enjoy it. My goal was to bring together a group of friends, some of whom have never actually played any role-playing games at all, and create an ongoing and engaging campaign story in the Star Wars universe. I chose Star Wars because it was a new game system for all of us that offered some interesting narrative opportunities and a bit of a change of scene, maybe, from Dungeons & Dragons, which we were used to playing, or at least some of us were used to playing. Of course, another major reason is I grew up loving Star Wars since I was a child. We are using the Fantasy Flight Games Star Wars Force and Destiny rule system, although we have a couple veteran D&D players in our group for this campaign. Most of the group has little or no experience with role-playing games, and I'm new to serving as Game Master myself. Thus, the veterans amongst our listeners will have to bear with us as we learn the rule system and navigate role-playing together via the internet, since we all live in different locations. We are very grateful for our listeners and certainly welcome you to share your feedback with us. You can find our website at www.candleorthenight.com. That's all one word. And our show email address is feedback@candleorthenight.com. I wanted to create an introductory episode to orient our listeners to the general setting of the campaign, as well as give some brief background to each of our player characters. This campaign takes place shortly after the events of the original 1977 Star Wars A New Hope, and before The Empire Strikes Back. This puts us somewhere around the year 1 ABY after the Battle of Yavin. In this time, the Empire is ascendant, the Jedi Order is no more, and the Rebel Alliance has just won an inspiring but very costly victory against the Empire. It is a very dark time. The fascist and totalitarian style of the Imperial regime casts a shadow over all of the life in the core worlds, the colonies, the Midrim. This is juxtaposed by the lawless, crime-ridden frontier of the Outer Rim, which is still pretty much controlled by pirates, organized crime, or super corporations. In this time, Force-sensitive individuals, those who could feel or use the Force, all over the galaxy, live in constant fear that the very thing that makes them unique and special could very well be what gets them reported by their neighbors to Imperial authorities and dragged from their homes at night, never to be heard from again. This is a time where Darth Vader hunts mercilessly under the command of the Empire for any survivors of Order 66, and any relic or history of the Jedi era is either pillaged by treasure seekers or burned to ashes by the Empire. The Rebel Alliance is scattered, poorly organized, and not well established yet, but their very existence brings hope to those that remember a brighter age, that this darkness may not be eternal. Though most are taught by Imperial propaganda that the Jedi were an extremist cult that staged an abortive political coup, there are some still alive who remember fondly the wisdom, nobility, and courage of the Jedi Order. They carry these memories silently, however, in the current dark times, and keep their heads down. But they're there. Our players find themselves in this world at this dark time, and they themselves are from different races, cultures, parts of the galaxy. Each of them very different from each other. However, they all share one rare characteristic. They are all Force-sensitive, and thus have some glimmer of the gift of the Force and basic knowledge of its use. It manifests quite differently for each of them, but they have kept it either a shameful secret or perhaps more of a repressed memory. They all try to just keep plugging along in their daily life, avoiding the Empire and surviving, until one fateful day that they begin to experience a powerful dream that cannot be ignored. They don't know it, but each of these different individuals all share exactly the same dream, and it is no mere dream, but actually a prophecy. In this dream, they are running in fear. This dream is always seen through the eyes of a Twi'lek female who lies in hiding with two other refugees. These refugees are Jedi. For whatever reason, they have escaped the destruction of Order 66 and had some mission, a mission that must have gone horribly wrong. This young Twi'lek Jedi's name is Alda. It is through her eyes that it is revealed that these refugees have fled disaster and sought refuge aboard a massive luxury liner called the Adhara Grey. This exquisite ship serves as a playground to the galaxy's most wealthy elite and was built and operated by a powerful corporation known as Rodial Luxury Holdings. Our Jedi refugees stowed away in the engine room of this great luxury liner, hoping to stay out of sight until the ship passed along the extreme edge of the Outer Rim, perhaps opening an opportunity for these refugees to escape into wild space. As the dreams keep recurring night by night to our heroes, more and more details begin to unfold. The Jedi refugees, it appears, were charged with protecting a scientist, one by the name of Dr. Galen Bendix. This scientist seems to have created some device of curious power. The discovery was priceless. It's not clear to our heroes what it does, but the Rebel Alliance would have done anything to keep it safe and away from the Empire. Only they had apparently failed, leaving these Jedi exposed and alone, living like vermin under the shadow of the most privileged titans of industry in the galaxy. Sadly, the dream always ends the same way. Alda waking up to a searing light emanating from Dr. Bendix's device as they hide away in the engineering deck. Something is wrong. But before she can even warn her companions, there is nothing but an all-engulfing light, and then nothingness. Though our heroes wake in a sweat at the end of this dream night by night, they try and take solace in the fact that it was just a recurring nightmare, perhaps trying to rationalize it away to themselves. Until one day comes that a news report catches each of their attention all over the HoloNet, and the news report says, "The corporate sector today was rocked by a tragic and unexpected explosion of a high-profile luxury space liner. The Adhara Grey exploded under mysterious circumstances outside of the Ruria system. No survivors were reported. The explosion created a bizarre anomaly in this region, a nebula that engulfs the first moon of Ruria. There has been no official investigation as of yet, since the area of the Outer Rim where this occurred has been deemed unsafe by the Imperial Security Bureau. The prevalence of piracy in the area, compounded by the appearance of a large subspace anomaly, makes safe travel challenging. Despite that, there has been increases noted in illegal travel to the area, primarily by profiteers and pirates. The Imperial Security Bureau recommends law-abiding citizens give the region a wide berth until the official investigation begins. In related news, rebel incursions in this previously quiet area of the Outer Rim have been increasing lately, with the rebels perhaps seeking to capitalize on the destabilization of the region." And thus, in conclusion, there can be only one explanation. These were no mere dreams. On some level, our heroes knew this, but the news report only solidifies what they suspected. This was a prophetic vision, a glimpse of the future. They somehow knew this would happen. With little concern anymore for the mundanities of their daily lives, they sought to investigate what they felt was the tug of destiny on the chaotic strings of their lives. It might explain what they always knew about themselves, that they were different. Regardless, they each beg, borrow, steal, or sell whatever they can to arrange unofficial passage on a freighter to the Ruria system in the Outer Rim. They're really not sure what it is they're looking for, but they feel they'll know it when they get there. This accident, and the anomaly birthed from it, resonate with the touch of the Force. The heroes each come to the conclusion that they must find answers to who these refugees were and what became of them. And it is here that the first session begins. Our heroes have booked passage on the same freighter, bound for the distant moon of Ruria Prime, wrapped in this bizarre nebula. Now, some of our players wanted to provide a brief character background to give our listeners an opportunity to get an idea of who their characters are. We'll wrap up this introductory episode with these brief character backgrounds, starting with Tyrus.
My character's name is Tyrus Van Donnermune. He is a shade over 6 feet tall, and his appearance is typical of his race. He's quite thin, with an elongated skull and the trademark towering forehead. He is hairless, and his skin is somewhere between pasty and cement due to lack of sun exposure. His people are clearly most comfortable indoors. Tyrus is a highborn member of the Mune species, who for generations have controlled banking and commerce both for the Republic and the Empire. The Mune prize education and status above all, and are cautious, calculating, and disciplined, but also ambitious and merciless. Only those that rise to the top of their highly conformist society are deemed worthy of respect, while those who fail to make the grade are treated with contempt. In fact, it's this combination of characteristics that leads to the credo that all non-Mune species are inferior beings, and that it was the Mune's birthright to plunder wealth and resources wherever they were found. They spoke of honor and sanctity of a contract, which was sanitized through the illusion that the Mune would guide and protect other worlds, only to use their cunning and superior negotiation skills to exploit them. Tyrus navigated this ruthless meritocracy and was rewarded by his family with riches and responsibility. As is often the case, however, this made him a target of intrigue and jealousy both from rivals as well as from members of his own family. An attempt was made to destroy him, which he discovered and turned to his advantage, but with unforeseen consequences which cost him an unbearable price. In this moment, his Force abilities manifest for the first time. It was in this moment that his Force abilities manifested for the first time in an uncontrolled and primal spasm which sealed his fate and turned him into a fugitive. Cut off from his family, disillusioned with the role that fate had thrusted upon him by his conformist society, Tyrus finds himself on a transport with an unlikely mix of strangers, which is where our story begins.
Hi, my name is Sarah, and I am the player of Jinsa. I think this is a particularly interesting point in the history of the Star Wars universe. It is a very bleak time if you are Force sensitive or someone who was a Jedi who managed to eke through. As such, I tried to incorporate as much of that into my character's history as possible without stepping on anything canon. Jinsa was born on one of the Outer Rim worlds. She is actually not sure of her planet of origin. When she was pretty much just a baby, she was picked up by a Jedi who was on an errand for the Council. He recognized her Force sensitivity and managed to convince her parents that she would be better off with him and be provided with a better future, education, and so on. As this individual was running a mission for the Council, he could not personally escort her back to Coruscant where she would see her proper education. Instead, he left her at a out-of-the-way Jedi monastery that was in the vicinity in the hopes that they would be able to transfer her from there. Unfortunately for Jinsa, or perhaps fortunately, depending on how you look at it, the trade war broke out. This left Jinsa basically stranded. I kind of envisioned the monastery that she was stranded on as a historically valuable temple to the Jedi, but not one that was in practical application or use at current day. As such, three or four Jedi that were more interested in self-meditation on the greater understanding of the universe or perhaps the nature of the Force were there all the time as kind of guardians and caretakers. However, it was not in active use. These Jedi basically started Jinsa down the road of becoming a Jedi. She did receive some early training meditation techniques, the typical things you would kind of expose a Padawan to. However, it was not formal, and the hopes was always that she would be moved to Coruscant. Unfortunately, as the war raged on, she was kind of low priority as a child compared to other issues that was facing the Order and the universe at large. When Order 66 was issued, the monastery she was at was considered a lower priority, likely due to its isolation and the few number of Jedi known to be there. Because of that, the Jedi that were basically Jinsa's immediate family at that point in time were able to start making arrangements to get her out as well as themselves. Unfortunately, before all those arrangements could be made, the stormtroopers set upon the temple. Because the monastery was a place that they did not expect to find children, a cook on the premises was able to claim Jinsa was theirs, and they were able to escape. However, not before Jinsa witnessed the slaughter of the three individuals that had basically been raising her and were the only family that she knew she had. From there, the individuals that had initially been working with the Jedi to get Jinsa out quickly realized that things were turning in the favor of the Empire. I would assume that they had thought that perhaps the Jedi would manage to pull through and that they would get some sort of reward or bonus for helping save this one child. Unfortunately, when it became apparently clear that that was not the case, they basically cut Jinsa loose and let her slide through the cracks. Also, I feel it's relevant at this point to mention that Jinsa's primary powers are foresight, and I assume that's something that she probably had very early on. So in addition to watching her family get killed, during the same period of time, she's having visions of the very violent deaths of a lot of different Jedi. There was a lot of very prominent people in the Force getting snuffed out under a very quick period of time, and I can't help but think that she might have had some very strange, terrible nightmares during this period. All in all, I would assume she was left very traumatized by this, and in addition to that, she was kind of cut to the wind. She had to quickly learn to pull her weight on smuggling ships and freighters to stay alive. She had no one watching out for her and nowhere to turn. She basically retreated into a type of survival mode. She kind of prioritized that she needed to stay out of the sight of the Empire and under the radar as much as possible and as far away from the core worlds as possible. As such, she ended up working with cartels and for smugglers and whoever she could get to hire her without asking too many questions for whatever duration of time that the work held up, unless something happened that might have made them suspicious, at which point she would cut ties and bolt. Working for these unsavory people kind of only added to this very bleak outlook on the universe and its inhabitants. She does not think that the universe is a happy place. She thinks that people are inherently bad and probably willing to stab you in the back at the nearest opportunity. She kind of looks back at her childhood and the Jedi Order with a fair amount of childhood kind of fantasy rolled into it, that these were like the last good people in the world and the world killed them, basically. And this has led to some conflicting feelings. Sometimes in her life, she looks back at the Order with a whole lot of nostalgia, and at other times she looks back and she becomes very, very bitter and angry. Reflecting on the life that she could have had things been different, is probably something that keeps her up at night. However, she knows that there is no point in dwelling on the past, and she had to move forward as best she could. In most situations where Jinsa was asked how she kind of knew things were going to happen before they did, she would always say she just listened to her gut feelings. And kind of played it off as best she could that she was just very, very lucky. It's through this line of smuggling work and freelance jobs to get her from point A to point B, kind of always staying on the move, that she had several run-ins with Victor. She kind of has mixed feelings about Victor. On one hand, she maybe has a little bit of a crush on him. On the other, she thinks he's terrible, terrible, terrible luck. So it'll be interesting to see where that goes. On her last adventure with Victor, she took a job moving some goods for him that turned out to be a bunch of sedated, force-sensitive children that were being sold to the Empire. When Victor found out what the cargo actually was, he informed Jensa, and the two of them jettisoned the rest of their crew into deep space. Victor lied to the Empire and claimed that the ship had been destroyed in space. And he and Jensa moved the children to safety. And it's during that trip that they realized that the both of them were having the same visions as all these kids of the events that kind of get revealed in the first couple of episodes. Anyway, I hope that gives you some insight on Jensa. She's kind of at a crossroads. At this point in her life, she has given up on all hope, so the events as they unfold will kind of make or break her as a character. I hope you enjoy listening to us play.
Bajor Shin is a Miri Allen. As a child, his family, who traded goods throughout the galaxy, were murdered by pirates seeking out a force-sensitive Miri Allen child. Fortunately, Bajor was saved by Dretak Ophi and was taken under his wing and trained as an elite guardian. His nickname, the Star Guardian, is well known throughout the galaxy. His life has made him a stoic and disciplined fighter, who is also gifted in the arts of healing, both through medicine and the Force. At his core, he is good, but there is always some wiggle room for the law, where certain laws may conflict with a job. He is the Space Ronin.
So Victor's, he's an middle-aged gentleman. He's probably in his mid-40s. And he's starting to gray. It's usually a fairly shaggy appearance, as he does have a kind of rugged and roguish smuggler look to him. So he's got, you know, salt and pepper hair and no distinguishing marks, but he definitely, he can blend in with that kind of outlaw crowd in his dress, in his demeanor. And the way he interacts, it's you can tell that he's been in this line of work for a long time. It all comes very naturally to him.
Have you given any thought to where he's from originally?
So in the earliest days, he actually grew up in the Core Worlds, and his life in the Core Worlds was very normal, all under the Republic at the time. You know, he had happy mom and dad family. He was an only child, and he excelled, especially in when it came to advancing socially, and as well as he didn't have an adaptive mind for his computer work. It's a skill that he really worked hard at. He was very much into systems, and that allowed him to, just through pursuit, he wasn't someone who has the kind of knack for slicing. It's somebody he's very much self-taught and a by-the-book learner. It was a very practiced and pursued field for him. And it ended up kind of being his mainstay as a crew member on some of these smuggler ships. He would run computers. He has an interest in networks and systems of all kind, be they individuals, computers, so part social dynamics, part AI, intelligence systems, computers, and the like. And he ended up merging those two into his field. You know, and fast forward several years later, he's out of the Core Worlds. He's in the Outer Rim, And that's where he made a name for himself.
Doing what? What was he up to, at least to the degree that perhaps you want to share with the listeners at the beginning?
So, arriving in the Outer Rim, still during the age of the Republic, he initially kind of sold himself out as a slicer, as someone could get things done, but he really flourished in the Outer Rim, operating, you know, black market intel, and primarily he was a connections guy. As much as he was a reliable cracker, he could also, he knew who you could work with to get a job done. And so, you know, part of the life he lived in the Outer Rim was not only as a slicer, but as somebody who kind of socially engineered various crews, even maybe competitors, got them to either work together or to, you know, excel at what they were doing. And in this lifestyle, he also got to know one of the other player characters. He had run into Jensa several times, and they had done several missions together, worked with several different crews together.
And given that all of the hero characters are force sensitive, and all of them have come to that realization, or at least most of them have, some maybe not quite aware of it yet, any thought to how Victor may have first manifested the Force, or at least gotten a hint that he was somehow different or special?
So when it comes to the Force, he actually knows very little about the Force. In most of his adult life, he operated in the Outer Rim, and the goings-on of the universe, the transition from the Republic to the Empire, was kind of happening in the background in his very fast-paced, you know, very demanding lifestyle. You know, he lived on the edge. He was a slicer, gunslinger, working with bandits and nefarious space individuals. He didn't have time to track the progress of the Clone Wars. He didn't really get involved. He already had his tasks at hand to deal with, and he focused on that. And as part of that, he didn't really pay attention to Jedi. He actually, you know, you think about the Empire era and how Jedis are kind of like, and the Force is mumbo jumbo to a lot of people. That's kind of the perspective he would have, you know, hokey religion. He doesn't really know anything about the Jedi. He doesn't really know anything about the Force, just what he's heard in passing. And in prior days, you could say he may have been a non-believer. And things have definitely changed. I think in the game, you really see, as the story progresses, Victor's realization of what the Force actually is. But as far as his background goes, it's almost, it's just something he encountered in passing.
Any important persons in his life, from his history, or people he cares greatly about?
You know, he's operated as a loner in the Outer Rim, just surrounded by scum and villainy. He has people that he works with, that he trusts, people that he works with that he cares about, and in his days may have had some romantic trysts, producing no offspring. But this kind of lifestyle that he lived, it's not a settle down lifestyle. It's as you go, and that's kind of the way he's lived. There are definitely people in his past that if they reached out to him, he would be there to help, but they're few and far between, just the nature of the company he kept.
Very good. Any other details you'd like to tell us?
So I don't know how much Jensa went into her background, just the prior events to the campaign's onset, but Victor and Jensa were working with some smugglers under the impression that they were, you know, running standard goods. And they came to find out by investigating the cargo that they were not really supposed to look at. It's kind of a black box, you know, you're just there to do the job. They come to realize that they were actually smuggling children. And that is a line that Victor and Jensa, of course, never wanted to cross. He also made some very interesting details investigating where this freighter was heading. He found that it wasn't heading to, you know, like a HUD cartel or your typical like skin traders. It was heading to an Imperial base. And that definitely gave him some pause. So as the story goes, Jensa and Victor having prior arrangements, and he kind of knew her boundaries and how far he could trust her, they decided to take action and that they weren't going to let these children be taken. And so basically they secured themselves in an area of the ship that they could maintain life support, closed the doors, and they ejected all of the remaining crew out to space. They were able to take those children to one of Victor's prior contacts, who had helped him in the past when situations like this arose and he had to step in and do what was right. And from there, he and Jensa kind of made plans to follow some of these dreams they were having. And that's how he takes the stage, so to speak, in the campaign.
And that's how he leads into the beginning of the adventure. And that wraps up our character introductions. And now we will move on to sort of the wrapping up of this introductory episode. I suppose that I should also perhaps give an explanation for the title of our show. This title was inspired by a quote from Yoda. And that quote, this quote was from one of the novels, actually, called Yoda, Dark Rendezvous by Sean Stewart. And the quote, the context was that Yoda was speaking to one of his Padawans and trying to impress upon this Padawan the importance of choice in defining one's destiny. And the quote was, quote, "To be a Jedi is to face the truth and choose. Give off light or darkness, Padawan. Be a candle or the night, but choose." Quote, close quote. The reason I like that quote, and I think it defines exactly what we're trying to do for this campaign, is the game system for Star Wars Force and Destiny has morality as a central kind of game mechanic. The game system allows for players to be light-sided or dark-sided and to sort of exist on that spectrum. Choices the characters make can alter their destiny towards the dark side, and they can be redeemed. And, or if they so choose, they can become paragons of the light. And these choices and the freedom to choose between them are sort of central to the entire game system. And so that quote stood out to me as a great inspiration for what this campaign would be. That about wraps it up for our introduction. Hope you enjoyed it, and I look forward to exploring this campaign with all of you.